This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting on demand from Buffalo, New York, broadcasting from the walk-in closet for one last time. WWE is reconsidering and reevaluating and postponing its move to its new headquarters from one location in Stamford, Connecticut to another location in Stamford, Connecticut. I am moving the WrestleNomics headquarters from one location in Buffalo, New York to another location in Buffalo, New York. But today is WWE Q2 July 30th, 2020, and WWE went to the SEC, went to the public today, and reported earnings. And what did we get? The big takeaways, as I've been trained to do, is tell me what the five big takeaways are, biggest being, number one, WWE overperformed in terms of the profits that financial analysts in Wall Street were expecting. Financial analysts in Wall Street were expecting about $12 million on the quarter from net income. WWE has reported, let's pull it up here, go to the trending schedules. Go to the bottom line where it says net income. Q2, $43.8 million in profit. That's after expenses. That's after taxes. That's after interest. $44 million when the market was expecting 12. WWE slightly underperformed on revenue expectation, but that's secondary when they pulled the expected level of profit, which I cannot deny brings to mind objections that were raised at the time on April 15th, 2020, this year, when WWE announced a number of cost-cutting measures, including laying off and furloughing employees, and more memorably, firing a number of talent. Some WWE defenders, even those unlike Jerry McDivitt, who are not compensated by WWE, they merely defend WWE on Twitter or other social media platforms. They said that WWE had to cut costs. It was merely a matter of keeping the company profitable and not in the red. WWE's total reported net income for the first half of 2020 now totals $70 million. That's not revenue. That's net income. That's basically the latest form of profit after all the expenses and taxes and so forth are taken out. What does that mean in context? Last year, a very profitable year for WWE, 2019, WWE reported a total for the entire year of $77 million in net income. They are now already in half a year at $70 million. WWE now just needs to make another $30 million in net income. And remember, in the first 6 months, they've already made $70 million. They only need to make another $30 million for the rest of the 6 months remaining in the year to achieve the company's most profitable year ever. Already made $26 million in Q1, $44 million in Q2. That means they only need to make an average of $15 million for each of the two remaining quarters of the year to set the all-time net income record for a year. Seems like a foregone conclusion to me. And yes, it will be the most profitable year ever, even exceeding the greatest days of the Attitude Era, even exceeding the years 1998, 1999, 2000, and 2001, when WWE was much more popular. Even when you adjust those years for inflation to modern US dollars, even adjusting for inflation, WWE's most profitable year ever was 2018, when they recorded $99.6 million in net income. That is the record. The WWE we know today is more profitable than the WWE of the glory years of the Attitude Era. And this year is well on track to be the most profitable year ever by a wide margin during a pandemic. But not only that, WWE, the company that is struggling to stay alive and just had to cut costs, wrote this as one of the bullet points on page one of its earnings release. It said, quote, "Management may resume its opportunistic acquisition of stock, under the company's $500 million share repurchase program, subject to WWE's business outlook and liquidity, as well as whether share repurchases compare favorably to other capital allocation alternatives. What does that mean? That means WWE is telling the public, we're thinking about resuming our stock buyback program, which we suspended months ago due to COVID-19 concerns. WWE is thinking about restarting its stock buyback program. What is a stock buyback program? It's essentially when a company uses the cash that it makes from its business to buy shares of its own stock, thus increasing the demand for the stock, hopefully increasing the price of the stock, and thus delivering more value to shareholders, making all of the shares that are held by WWE investors worth more money, have more value. Possibly related, who is the biggest WWE shareholder? Vincent K. McMahon. Who else holds a lot of shares? Well, big financial institutions like Lindsay Train, I think, is the biggest institutional owner. But the next person who leads in terms of being a shareholder is Chief Brand Officer Stephanie McMahon. A lot of other executives hold stock as well. But the point here is that WWE increases liquidity. It made sure it had lots of cash on hand by cutting a lot of costs, including cutting employees and talent. And it's using cash now. It's considering using cash to buy back its own stock. So who is that good news for? That's good news if you're a WWE shareholder, especially if you are a large shareholder like Vince McMahon or Stephanie McMahon or Lindsay Train Limited or BlackRock. Great news if those major institutional investors are controlling your retirement funds. Not the best news if you are someone who is laid off by WWE recently. And it's easier to think about the talent who were laid off, who have names and faces that we know, but many of whom will find opportunities elsewhere or already have, in fact. I think the people who really got the bad end of this are not the talent who are already making six figures, but maybe the WWE corporate employees who were laid off as a result of the cost cutting, whose names we don't know and whose salaries are probably much lower. What other key takeaways are there? In the Q&A, the most interesting part of the day, perhaps, Vince McMahon faced a lot of questions about the ongoing decline of ratings for Raw and SmackDown. We'll get to that in some detail. Another interesting point, e-commerce had an outstanding quarter. In Q2, e-commerce sold $12.6 million in online merchandise sales, the biggest quarter, at least within the last few years, maybe ever, biggest quarter in a long time, at least. We don't know how many orders were made or what the average order price was. We'll find that out later in the actual 10Q quarterly report, which will give us some more detail. That hasn't come out yet. WWE should be publishing that with the SEC within a day. Product licensing sales, or at least revenue, seemed to be up, as it definitely was, up to $9.7 million, which is up from $9.4 million in the prior Q2. Basically, what does that mean? It means that probably video game and action figure sales were slightly higher in this Q2 versus last year's Q2. So consumer products, despite there being no venue merchandise, there were no events, so therefore there was no venue merchandise, there was no merchandise sales at events because there were no events, but somewhat that was offset by people apparently going online and ordering WWE merchandise. Another key takeaway, the WWE Network, we always, in each quarter, we get some news about how the WWE Network performed in terms of attracting paid subscribers. Average paid subscribers in the quarter was actually down slightly, making it the fifth consecutive quarter that paid subs have been down. However, end period subs, that is the number of paid subs at the end of the quarter, in this case, June 30th, that was up slightly, and there was a lot of discussion about the free tier that has been introduced. It was introduced on June 1st, so there are a lot of questions, a lot of discussion about that. We'll get into some more detail about that in a little while. And there was also the emergence of Executive Vice President of the Advanced Media Group, J.R. Donlan, answered a lot of questions at the deference of Vince McMahon on this call. J.R. Donlan also spoke somewhat at the annual shareholders meeting that happened on July 16th. A couple other interesting things at the front here. We learned a tidbit about WWE geo-blocking its YouTube content in India, apparently to appease its Indian broadcast partner, Sony. We know from previous comments that WWE executives have made that WWE's most popular market for its YouTube content is India. We've heard it, it sounded like, evidently from some comments, that people in India made up about 70 to 80% of WWE's YouTube viewing. Apparently, they are geo-blocking some of the content. They didn't say which content. I would guess that it's the content related to Raw and SmackDown, maybe NXT as well. Another thing at the front, there was a quick question about Evolve, WWE's acquisition of the WN-associated brand Evolve. Interim CFO Frank Riddick said that it called it a small acquisition, a content acquisition, something that's pretty small in the corporate picture of WWE, but is interesting to wrestling fans. So as always, later in the podcast, we're going to play some actual clips from actual WWE executives and the financial analysts who asked questions in the Q&A. And we're going to go over now my predictions of WWE's key performance indicators and my predictions of their revenue reporting, their overall profit, in this case, operating income reporting. My predictions versus what WWE actually reported. How far off was I? Let's find out. Let's start with key performance indicators, and then we'll go to the actual finances and get really hardcore with the numbers later. But starting with the KPIs first, I predicted for worldwide average paid subs throughout the quarter. So basically that means you take the paid subs on each day, on all 90 days, for April, May, and June, and you average, what was the average number of paid subs we had throughout the 3 months? I predicted 1,553,000. The actual number was 1,661,000, 7% higher than what I predicted. For US, I was also off by 7%, and for international, I was off by 6%. I predicted for international 427,000 paid subs. The actual number, 454,000. Average attendance, what do you know? I was right on the money. North America, 0. International, 0. Next up, TV viewership. TV viewership is pretty easy to predict because they are now reporting what we call the P2+, the total audience viewership. They used to report a TV rating, but now switching to the actual number of viewers. I predicted for Raw, 1.842 million. The actual number that they reported was 1.838. Why are those numbers off from what is on Showbiz Daily? I'm guessing they get some more final version of the number that they're probably putting into their calculation. So off by 0%. If I actually take that out to a decimal, to one decimal place, I was off by 0.2%. SmackDown, I was too low by 1%, predicting 2.085. They actually got 2.099, so pretty close on TV viewership, which again, I'm basically cheating on. AVOD, Global Hours Viewed, the video viewing that's happening on ad-supported platforms like YouTube and Facebook, I predicted, based on the Social Blade numbers that I had read, showing that WWE had its biggest quarter ever for YouTube views, so I predicted 510 million hours of viewing time, only 374, so I was way off there, too high by 27%. Likewise, for just the number of views, so not the minutes being viewed, but just the number of video views, I predicted 14.2 billion, and I was about 4 million too high, or 4 billion too high. The actual number was 9.9, so off by 30% there. And then social media followers were actually down for the first time ever. I'm guessing that has to do with the talent cuts because they're including all the talent and all the brand social media accounts in their counting is what I've always understood. So it makes sense, I guess, that number would be down in a quarter where they made significant, maybe the sort of the biggest talent cuts they probably made in such a short period of time. So the I predicted 1.1 billion total social media followers. It actually turned out to be 1.08. So I just predicted incremental increases on the three areas that they report, which are Facebook, Twitter, and other social media. Other social media includes Instagram probably as the largest piece, and they were down. So going on to finances now, looking at the revenues, I didn't try to predict profits for each segment, but they do report revenues for each segment. So we've got, I think it's 9 segments here. Let's count them up real quick. There are 11 segments that they report revenue for. Of course, they only report profit for the three divisions. So we start with the media division. There are a media division, a live events division, and a consumer products division, and they break down segments within those three divisions for revenue only. So the first segment is the network / pay-per-view segment. I predicted $48 million. It turned out to be $49 million. I was a little bit low there. I was too high on core content rights fees, predicting about $140 million for Raw and SmackDown fees. It really turned out to be $133 million. Media ads and sponsors was an interesting one because there had been a lot of talk in the industry that ad demand was down because of the economy overall, and the expectation was that WWE would be affected, and it was. I predicted that it would be down by about 33% year over year. It was down. It did a little bit better than that. I predicted $12.7 million, but I was pretty close. It ended up being $13.3. The other media segment I was way off on. I predicted $15.5 million, and it turned out to be just $4.5. What's in the other media segment? Usually it's major money from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for the major events there. There, of course, wasn't a Saudi Arabia event in this quarter. There's usually two per year, so there wouldn't have been one this quarter in all likelihood anyway. But what's in this segment is WWE Studios, the reality TV programs, which there was a full season of Total Bellas in this segment, which did quite well, and which did get a mention in the earnings press release. But only $4.5 million. I wonder if the Big Show money that came from that show appeared on Netflix in April. I wonder if that is included in here at all. I didn't see any note yet, but maybe the 10Q, which will come out hopefully tomorrow, will tell us. In the live events division, of course, there was no North American ticket sales, no international ticket sales. I was right on the money on those. But there was $300,000 in advertising and sponsors related to events. I have no idea how they ended up with some money in that category, but they did. And in the other area for events, which includes things like travel packages and secondary ticket sellers, in consumer products, I predicted 7.7 for product licensing, which includes things like action figures and video games and mobile games. 7.7, it turned out to be 9.7, so that did better than I thought it would, by about 26%. Venue merchandise, I predicted 0. It was 0. And e-commerce, I was down by a full 110%. I predicted $6 million, and it turned out to be $12.6 million in online merchandise sales. Now, I guess that those mainly happen on WShop, but probably also through other sellers like Amazon. CFO Frank Riddick did put over on the call that they had introduced a number of title belts, custom title belts. I think the Brahma Bull Rock title belt was mentioned, maybe the Stone Cold Steve Austin one. Sorry, I don't know if the Bray Wyatt Fiend belt that has been much talked about and was sold for like thousands of dollars or something. I don't know if that was included. So overall, I predicted $229.3 million in total revenue for the company in the quarter. It turned out to be 223.4. So I was too high by 3%. Total operating income for the quarter, I predicted 70.9 million, turned out to be just 55.7. So there you go. We've gone through the three divisions in WWE's reporting finances and the 11 segments within those three divisions. Something that should be taught in every school around America for all the future WWE Universe members. We'll take a quick run through some of the questions that financial analysts asked next, and then we'll go through some of your questions fielded through Twitter. And leading off, we'll listen to this question from the conference call from Lightshed's Brandon Ross, who addressed Chairman and CEO Vince McMahon about ratings.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for taking the questions. I have some follow-ups on the ratings issues that were identified a little earlier. First, why do you think, these are for Vince, why do you think AEW and NXT have bounced back better from the initial COVID shock than Raw and SmackDown? And then based on your commentary last quarter, it seemed you had a strategy for fixing Raw that indicated patience in, quote, getting over some newer talent. Did you abandon that plan in firing Heyman? And more broadly, why did you fire Heyman? And lastly, given Paul's recent relative success with NXT, do you think he could be of help on Raw and or SmackDown in an elevated role? Thank you.
That was a lot.
Sorry. We could break it down if you want. But just first, why do you think AEW and NXT have bounced back better from the initial COVID shock than Raw and SmackDown?
I think some of those are new. Something that's new and what have you. And it's up to us to make Raw and SmackDown feel more useful. That is where we're going. As far as continuing on, I said what was new and building characters. You always have to build characters constantly. And it seems to me that, you know, as far as Paul Levesque helping out on Raw and SmackDown, that happens. It's all hands on deck in terms of all that we do. As far as Paul Heyman is concerned, he did, I thought, a very, very good job in terms of creativity.
So that's Lightshed's Brandon Ross asking the question with Vince McMahon answering. And to put this in some context, on Tuesday, Lightshed came out with a blog on its website. Lightshed is a media analysis firm, and they came out with a blog about WWE stock. So Lightshed, the people associated with it, were formerly a part of a firm called BTIG, but now they've reorganized under Lightshed, and they post these blogs periodically about stocks that they're interested in, including among them WWE. And in an article that went up on Tuesday under the bylines of Brandon Ross, Rich Greenfield, and Mark Kelly, just to read an excerpt here. COVID or no COVID, creative appears to be at the center of the issues. Vince McMahon has acknowledged things need to change multiple times. However, while there have been short-lived experiments, the content appears to continuously return to a similar formula under his absolute control. McMahon went so far as to hire creative heads for Raw and SmackDown a year ago, with Paul Heyman heading Raw and Eric Bischoff heading SmackDown. And we know how that turned out later on. One of the largest problems we have identified is an inability to create new superstars. Every era of WWE wrestling has been defined by some key stars at the top. Recent years have been bereft of that star power, with Roman Reigns the closest, but never on that same level. More broadly, there really has been very little younger talent that have broken through at all on their way to replenishing even the middle level of stars in the men's division. End quote. So in light of that, not really a surprise that Brandon Ross asked the questions that he did. And I do think it's rare that you see someone from the financial community come out with a view of WWE stock that appears to get to the heart of what at least I think are a lot of the core issues. And I think the issue is that just that the analysts look at the company and they look at the documents and they don't study or know much about the content. And WWE is one of many other companies that they study. So I think a great job here by Lightshed and by Brandon Ross. And I think he asked appropriate questions. And I think Vince McMahon did not like it if his response of "that's a lot" is any indication. And maybe his tone otherwise. He didn't really seem to have an answer for what WWE was going to do about ratings. There were a number of other questions about ratings on this call. Vince stressed repeatedly that the live audience is really important. He seemed to be blaming a lot of it on the lack of live audience, which is fair. But as Brandon Ross raised, Raw and SmackDown have suffered worse than NXT and AEW. If we take the period of January 1st to March 12th, which is right before COVID restrictions go into place and empty arena wrestling begins. So basically, that's every episode of the major four programs that happened in 2020 before COVID started to affect them. if I compare that to the last 2 months of the of those four programs, if I compare those two periods for each of the four programs, I find that in total.
In the hobby, it's not easy being a fan of ripping packs or repacks. We hype ourselves up thinking, maybe I can pull a Ken Griffey Jr. rookie card, but with zero transparency on available cards and hit rates, it's all just a shot in the dark. Until now. Introducing Slab Packs from ArenaClub.com, the only repack that provides real value, a complete view of all possible cards, and clear hit rates for each one. Now, when I buy Slab Packs at Arena Club, it finally feels like I know what I'm getting. I was able to open an Arena Club Slab Pack, and I'll be honest, it was a lot better than what you normally do. Say you go to a card show, and there's a random innocuous brown bag of cards, and yeah, you can open it and look, it's going to be junk. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're probably going to get in those. Maybe you find that fun, and sometimes I do. Sometimes I like just opening up cards and saying, ah, hey, look at some random cards or whatever. But if you're really in this game to find value and find particular cards, it sucks to have to buy these mystery packs, and it ends up being, you know, almost nothing, you know, nothing of value. Not with Arena Club. You get a display, again, of all available cards, hit rates, grading. So you know that when you're opening up the slab pack, you are going to get something valuable. You are getting something good. And Arena Club, in addition to having those great slab packs we just talked about, is also a marketplace for card collecting, buying, trading, selling, displaying, all that sort of stuff. But those Arena Club slab packs, man, they are revolutionizing the repack game with transparency. After your pulls are revealed, they'll immediately be placed in your vault for safekeeping or trading and selling, and you can have them officially graded by Arena Club as well. So again, sending these things off, it's going to be officially graded by Arena Club. And the Arena Club grading process is accurate, fast, and transparent, with full grade rationale provided and explanation of how your card was scored. So whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform that you have to check out. So right now, I've got a special offer here for Voices of Wrestling Network listeners. You can get 10% off of your first purchase by going to arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet. Now, that's a crazy offer. That's 10% off a $400 slab pack. $40 off right there. 10% off your first purchase. No matter what that purchase is, 10% off. Off. Again, that's arenaclub.com/VOWnet, arenaclub.com/VOWnet for 10% off your first purchase on Arena Club. And we thank them for sponsoring the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. What's going on, guys? This is Rich from the Flagship Podcast here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. If I could have a moment of your time, I'd like to tell you about one of our sponsors, Eufy Video Lock. Eufy Video Lock is a smart lock, a 2K camera, and a doorbell, all 3-in-1, offering you triple security. So you can have everything in one device rather than installing many pieces on your front door. But it's not just for security. The Eufy Video Lock is also for convenience. No more concerns about losing keys, and you can assign passwords to your family members and see them coming back home via the integrated cameras. Some other great features we love about the Eufy Video Lock is it is easy to install and set up with just a Phillips screwdriver, no drilling required. Keyless entry, no more fumbling for keys when your hands are full. You never have to worry about kids losing keys or passing among renters. You also have 0.3 second fingerprint recognition and 1 second unlocking. Again, 0.3 seconds, it's going to recognize your fingerprints, and in 1 second, it's going to unlock. And with the AI self-learning chip embedded, the more you use it, the more accurate it will be. Also, no battery anxiety. You have a rechargeable battery in there that could last around 4 months, and you will get a low battery notification before it runs out. Passcode unlocking, a remote control with a 2K clear sight, see who's at your door, and control from anywhere through the Eufy app. With enhanced night vision, you can have optimized view even in the evening. You can also secure your package delivery by view and two-way audio. And then best of all, no monthly fee. A bunch of other brands out there are going to charge you a monthly fee. You have your recordings locally and you never have to pay for storage. Customer service, Eufy's got you handled as well. They are on standby for you 24/7, so you can enjoy a worry-free experience with an 18-month warranty, all backed by their professional customer service team. Contact them anytime by telephone, email, or live chat. Personally, as a homeowner, I love my Eufy video lock. I have the ability to see what's going on when I'm not home, when packages has arrived, and really the thing I love the most about it, the ease of being able to lock and unlock my doors without having to fumble with my keys, reach in my pocket, or wait, no, crap, they're in my backpack, all that sort of stuff. All this is happening while my dogs are barking at me. You know what? Not anymore with the Eufy video lock. I touch it. 0.3 second fingerprint recognition. 1 second, door is unlocked. Much, much easier. So if you want to jump on board with Eufy Video Lock, search Eufy Video Lock. That is E-U-F-Y Video Lock. Again, that's Eufy Video Lock, E-U-F-Y Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/videolock to see how you can gain complete control of your door.
Total viewership, Raw and SmackDown are down about 20%. Raw down 23%, SmackDown down 21%, NXT is only down 1% in its total audience. AEW is down 16%. If we look at the key demo, Raw is down 32%, SmackDown is down 34%, while NXT is down 15%. So it's been hurt about half as much as Raw and SmackDown, and AEW is down 18%. So there's evidence to support what Brandon Ross is saying there that AEW and NXT haven't been hurt as bad, or they've bounced back somewhat after the initial hit from COVID. So if the main issue, or the only issue, is that there's not live audiences there, then why is Raw and SmackDown being affected more heavily than NXT and AEW? And Vince's answer to that is that, well, it's because they're new. Because AEW Dynamite is a new program, and NXT is not a new program, but it's new on its platform. Well, SmackDown is new on its platform on Fox, but, well, SmackDown has been on a major cable company for decades, but that was Vince's way to try to explain why shows in his control are down and why shows that are not in his control. In the case of NXT, he defers, apparently, creative approval authority largely, if not completely, to Paul Levesque. And of course, in the case of AEW Dynamite, that's a program totally separate from his company. So Ross raises in his question, when are we going to see Paul, he's referring to Paul Levesque, help out more on Raw and SmackDown? And Vince sort of responds saying that Paul does, which I'm sure he does, but Vince McMahon remains the head of creative and remains the approving authority and remains the person who sets the vision. But I think what Ross is trying to get at there, or at least what could be derived from his question, is that in NXT and in AEW, those are two programs that are not controlled by Vince McMahon. Raw and SmackDown are two programs that are controlled by Vince McMahon. And as far as the Paul Heyman question, there what's being referred to is that there were two positions, executive director positions that were created last year around this time, executive director of Raw and of SmackDown. Those positions were given to Paul Heyman and to Eric Bischoff, respectively. Eric Bischoff only lasted a few months, I think. Paul Heyman was relieved of those duties a few weeks ago. And Bruce Pritchard, who had replaced Bischoff in the executive director of SmackDown role, has been consolidated into both roles to, in the words of the WWE Twitter account, to streamline the creative process. And Vince's response to the question about why Heyman was removed from that role, he has no answer other than to say that Heyman did a very good job for us. So, fortunately for WWE, they find themselves in a situation where the value of their live content and of live content generally has exploded over the years, and there's no sign of stopping. And WWE did cost cutting, and they are more profitable than the market expected, and the stock is up in after hours trading, up from about $45 when the market closed to $48 last I checked. Elsewhere in the call, there was a question about the value of WWE possibly selling its pay-per-views or its network content off of the network into a major streaming platform, maybe like Peacock, maybe ESPN, maybe Amazon. A deal for WWE to do just that seemed imminent earlier in the year before COVID, which seems to have interrupted those negotiations. So the question was raised whether the potential value is still there for WWE to do what it called earlier a transformational deal, or was it a transformative strategy that would give WWE even more guaranteed revenue.
Look, we've seen cord cutting accelerate in the pandemic, which has made it easier for streamers to acquire subs than just even 6 months ago. And at the same time, you know, we've talked about the ratings being a bit challenged, which is understandable with some stars on the sideline. But for someone on the outside looking in, it would seem like maybe your negotiating leverage with a potential licensor of the network could have potentially taken a hit while the deal's on hold. So maybe it'd be helpful to understand what really stands out about the network to the licensors, and then what gives you sort of confidence this deal looks the same, whether it's 6-12 months from now when the deal gets done, instead of maybe coming in a bit lower than you initially expected.
Well, I think that obviously, as we talked about, we're continuing to invest in the network and driving further subscribers and engagement and building very compelling content, which makes it attractive to potential partners. The other part is just the way with the addition of streaming services with a number of entities, Disney, Comcast, et cetera, you know, we believe that there is, you know, the WWE product would be very attractive for some of those platforms. So with in the overall macro trends that you mentioned, you know, we are seeing increase in some of the limited streaming properties that are not doing well. So they're going to be clear winners and losers. And we certainly think that the WWE content would be valuable to one of those winners.
So there's interim CFO Frank Riddick taking that question. I'm not quite sure what he means by the limited streaming properties, but I think what he's saying there, or at least what the argument would be, is that there are many streaming players in the market now, and it's a competitive market. I think certainly a service like Peacock that was supposed to have the Olympics this summer, and maybe other platforms as well, need, you know, all the special exclusive content they can get to set themselves apart from the other options out there. And that should keep the demand strong for WWE's network content, or especially its pay-per-views. And my thought continues to be, I think they can sell the pay-per-views. Maybe they sell them for $100 million average annual value, maybe even less than that now. But if they can, I think they can still maintain a WWE network of their own, a subscription platform of their own that doesn't contain pay-per-views, but contains the library content, other content like 205 Live. Not that 205 Live is that valuable, but the library content is valuable, I think, to a few hundred thousand subscribers worldwide who would continue to hold that subscription for $10 a month. And I don't have a great understanding of what the costs are of the WWE Network in terms of just keeping the infrastructure viable, but it would seem to me that there is, just as there is in the case of UFC Fight Pass, which is presumably profitable, that there is a way to do a subscription streaming service that attracts 100,000 or 300,000 subscribers, and to keep it profitable, especially when you're not having to run expensive pay-per-views associated with it, and you sell those pay-per-views off for guaranteed money, which may or may not be good for the motivations of, you know, the creative brains of the company that has to promote these events. It may or may not be good for the long-term motivations of the company to continue to do, as they say, create compelling content. But financially, if you just look at it on paper, it's a more lucrative outcome to sell the pay-per-view events. Well, and by the way, the big question is, where do the NXT takeovers land? And maybe those stay on the network and continue to attract subscribers there and retain subscribers there. But that seems like a more lucrative and less volatile model than even the network, which was in part one of the selling points of the network internally, is that it would create a more stable, less volatile model than pay-per-view, which was, of course, a way of selling events individually, and the network is just a recurring charge. And we'll jump to your questions now, with a few questions from William. First, he asks, regarding the point that live events still had a $4.5 million in expenses despite no events happening, which, by the way, I checked on that, and it's really $3.5 million that I was overlooking, that WWE did make $1 million in the other segment and in the ads and sponsors segment, which I have no explanation for. But what is the current relationship WWE and its arena part of its WWE and its arena partners, and is the $4.5 million in expenses a payment to the venues for shows missed due to the pandemic? I would guess that it has something to do with venue holds. Vince mentioned on the annual shareholders meeting that They have a number of tentative dates, and those tentative dates keep getting pushed back further. I would guess it has something to do with, first of all, that. Secondly, there may be employee salaries that are included in that, I would guess. Maybe employee salaries are going to corporate and other, though. But it may be just be a combination of those, is my best guess. And question number two, what is the current situation with the current situation regarding the lack of venue for SummerSlam? Are they going to do something silly and buy or rent an island, given that they've been rejected by most of their partners so far? Well, I would note that Vince did say that he has a plan B, and he wouldn't say what it was, but who knows? The likeliest thing I can imagine that would be like that is maybe Vince making a deal with Dana White to use Fight Island. But apart from that, if they do have to, and this is more related to what was being talked about on the annual shareholders meeting, which, by the way, you can find, you can listen to on the corporate website, and you can read my summary at WrestleNomics.com. But there were some questions about what would happen if, with cases on the rise in Florida of COVID, what would happen if WWE had to leave Florida and was no longer allowed to do events in Florida? And I think there are other states, particularly states that maybe don't have the case rate per capita that Florida does, that would accept them. And that was even brought up on the April 23rd conference call for Q1. And I'm afraid I may have answered question number three. Does WWE's long-term relationship with the state of Florida due to the current pandemic help or harm them with the press going forward, similar to the event deal that they made with the KSA? The press, I don't think the press cares, or the media cares about what WWE does. There's not much that I think WWE could do to strongly affect their public perception. I do think, as a lot of people say, you know, people just kind of look at it as, well, it's all fake wrestling. I think even the financial analysts don't generally look at it much beyond that. It's this weird wrestling thing that they don't get. And I think the brand value and the ad value of WWE has generally been repaired in the last 10 years or so. And I think TVPG has helped with that. And I think a lot of the charity work that they do, as much as we can make fun of it and believe that it's morally superficial, I think that's helped. WWE and NBC Universal a few years ago launched this The Hero in All of Us campaign to try to attract better sponsors and better advertisers. So I think WWE as a ad value has never been better. But yet still they do the things like they're doing now, which was the way that they've handled COVID and the relationship with the Saudi government. That it's just to, as the next question is about the stock buyback. All this stuff, I think, is just too deep in the weeds for, I don't know, the general perception to distinguish. And WWE's, or pro wrestling's, perception is already sort of marred to begin with. And I do think there's a great deal more subtlety that people can view pro wrestling with, but generally, that's not what happens. Question number four, why are they thinking about resuming a stock buyback program given the current climate? Because it's good for investors. If you buy back your stock, you increase the value of your stock, and that's good for investors, and those are the people that you're serving there. You're serving the people who own the company. And it just so happens that the person who owns the highest portion of the company is the CEO. How badly is Bingo Night missed during these investor calls? And there is no, this is the second WWE conference call with no George Berrios, and therefore there's no Berrios bingo cards distributed. George Berrios, of course, is the former CFO and co-president of WWE, who was ousted on January 30th along with co-president Michelle Wilson. But maybe in the future. We have Christina Salen, who takes the CFO role effective August 3rd, just a few days away. So I'm sure she will be on the next conference call. But no telling if or to what degree she will use unusual buzzwords. And next, Jesse asks, is there a noticeable breaking point with Fox or USA that if ratings continue to slip, WWE would be in danger of perhaps not being canceled, but really put under pressure by those networks, a danger zone for ratings? I'm still very much trying to learn about how the economics of the TV industry work. I definitely, though, think the point at which Raw is no longer the number one ranked TV show on the USA Network. By the way, I don't know if I mentioned earlier, NXT is ranked number 3, according to WWE's press release, the number 3 show on the USA Network. I would guess that Chrisley Knows Best or something is number 2. But the point at which WWE Raw starts to slip from being the top USA show, and it's got a lot of margin in that regard, I think, the point at which Raw starts slipping out of regularly being in the top 5 on Monday night in cable in the key demo, and even while Raw's ratings and SmackDown's ratings, well, especially Raw, because Raw hasn't changed networks, even while Raw's viewership has declined steadily and somewhat predictably over the years, you know, it's fallen in half from 2015. But while it's fallen in half from 2015, it hasn't changed in its rankings very much at all. And the best that I can tell, it's not so much the viewership numbers that are the most important thing to look at, but to look at the extent to which WWE programming is a peak program among all other programs on television. And probably what adds to its value is that a lot of people, while some people do DVR it, a lot of people do watch it live, and probably more so than they do other programs that are scripted entertainment. Secondly, in general, do you think the questions directed toward Vince are becoming more critical of WWE's creative decisions and the impact they may be having on business as compared to previous years? Creatively, I think this is a very insulated company. I don't think Vince is going to let the questions that he's being asked about ratings or about the creative direction bother him much. I don't know, if anything, it may make him dig his heels in further. But it's hard for there to be much of an impact while the company is in such good financial shape. And it's something that, you know, I talk about often here is that WWE has escalating TV rights fees. It's not just that the TV rights are big, and the contract that they got was a big upgrade, but that the way the contract is structured is that as the 5-year contract goes on, in the case of the US deal, those fees get larger and larger. And I imagine a lot of their international deals are structured similarly. The India deal took effect in Q2, they confirmed today. And the India deal is a 1.8x increase over the previous 5 years. And that is a brand new 5-year deal. And then on top of that, you've got the reporting today where they exceeded the profit expectations of the analysts. Maybe the analysts not fully understanding just how much more profitable Raw and SmackDown are to produce out of the Performance Center as opposed to out of arenas. You know, this was the first full quarter of that. There were only a couple weeks of that in Q1, but WWE beat analyst expectations. There's a stock buyback program, which makes the company, well, there's not a stock buyback program being resumed, but it's being discussed. And that's good news for investors, and it's good news for the stock price. So this company is very financially secure. As we talked about earlier, it's going to be more profitable this year than at any point in its history, adjusted for inflation. And I think what Vince is doing creatively creates short-term problems for the company. It created the AEW opportunity. Vince creating disenfranchised, not just fans, but disenfranchised talent is one of the necessary conditions, among others, that allowed the AEW opportunity to be viable. That led to higher costs for talent that may lead to more competition in sort of more subtle ways between WWE and AEW. We've seen, you know, Sky in 2 markets in UK and in Italy allow WWE to go elsewhere, and then Sky soon after acquire rights to AEW. Hard to say whether AEW's existence is a factor in that, but that happened. But long-term, more ominously, maybe bad creative and the weak ability to create stars, which leads to declining popularity of the product, which leads to lower viewership, maybe that eventually leads to WWE's TV rights value no longer being as valuable as it is or no longer growing in value. One of the points that was raised in the Lightshed article that I talked about earlier is that maybe there's a scenario in the future where, which is kind of like the situation we have now, where the peak content, the most watched content on TV, becomes extremely more valuable. So things that are live, mainly live sports, are the most valuable properties. But maybe eventually this trajectory continues to a point where it's only the most valuable among that category that gets really valuable, and everything else begins to fall to the wayside. Namely, what's being imagined here is that in order to better compete for NFL, you know, companies like NBCU and Fox would invest less in properties like WWE so that they could have more money to bid with on the NFL. And maybe that's how this TV rights cruise ship that WWE is sailing comes to a stop. But if that's the case, that's in the pretty far future, at least not for the next, you know, few years or so. WWE's current deals with NBCU and Fox run all the way through September 2024, with negotiations starting well before then, maybe a year and a half before then, maybe 2 years before then. I think a year and a half is when they complete the deal, usually. But generally, I think what fans want, maybe what a lot of people who listen to wrestling podcasts like this one want, is they want some sort of consequence for what they perceive as the content that's not very good, the TV shows that aren't very good. But we live in a complicated and strange media environment where WWE is getting less popular, but it is still increasingly valuable. At least Raw and SmackDown are. But I'm a little bit pressed for time this week. I've got to spend a little bit more time moving tomorrow. But there are a lot of other things I would always like to talk about. You know, Reddit, the Squared Circle Reddit subreddit, is that what it's called? Came out with its survey results, which are very interesting. I hope to take a close look at the data there. Still continuing to work on the result of the Pro Wrestling Favorability Survey, it was called, that I did. We'll eventually talk about that. And I came across last weekend, WWE had its, we knew it had its annual shareholders meeting, which it always does. Usually in every April, they have a shareholders meeting, I think somewhere at a hotel or something. And it would be in person, but this year, of course, because of coronavirus, they did it virtually. And I figured, well, this is going to be public. You have to hold shares and then you get a confirmation number and that's how you log in or something. I think thought that was what was going on. So I don't know if this was actually webcast live for the public or not, but I don't know how soon it did appear on the corporate website, but the audio is right there. The webcast of the audio is right there, and you can listen to it, anyone, whether you're a shareholder or not. I'm not a shareholder. I've never been a shareholder, but I came across the link, which may have been sitting there for 10 days, this annual shareholders meeting that happened on July 16th. And I guess on July 26th, I was just, you know, browsing the, like everybody does, browsing the WWE corporate website in the investors section, the investor overview. And somehow I was the first person who saw that the webcast link was there. And of course, I avidly listened to it and tweeted about it and wrote up a summary of it. And you can find that summary at WrestleNomics.com with the audio clips, with questions and answers. Of course, that's always the most interesting part, is the question and answer session. Usually, we're used to listening to these conference calls with questions from financial analysts. These were written in questions from shareholders, read by Investor Relations Senior Vice President Michael Weitz, but questions answered by Vince, by Paul Levesque, by Frank Riddick, even one by Stephanie McMahon. More J.R. Donlin responses in there as well. So you can read all about that and even listen to some of it at WrestleNomics.com, as I have some of the audio clips embedded in the blog article itself. So that's all I have for now. Look for me appearing on other podcasts, as I tend to do, especially quarterly around times like this. I'll be appearing for Post Wrestling. We're recording that tomorrow, Friday, and I may even be appearing elsewhere, so keep an eye out for that. And thanks to all the news sites that covered and gave credit to WrestleNomics for the annual shareholders meeting, for the quarter hour breakdown of AEW and NXT this past week. And if you've got a friend out there who's trying to understand the wrestling business and trying to have opinions about it, and they're not listening to or reading the work coming from the WrestleNomics brand, well, please do them the favor. Yeah, spread the good word of mouth. Any recommendations and good reviews and social media sharing you can do of the written or audio work that I do is very appreciated and greatly valued. It is, I've heard, much easier and much more profitable to do human interest stories. That's generally not what we do here. We try to understand the economics that, for better or worse, so motivate what happens in the pro wrestling industry. So that's all for me this week. You can follow WrestleNomics at WrestleNomics. You can go to WrestleNomics.com. You can follow me at Brandon Thurston. And I'm Brandon Thurston, and I will talk to you next time.